Hey everyone, and welcome back for another deep dive. You guys sent in some really fascinating stuff for us to dig into today.
Oh, yeah.
The mind-body problem.
It's a big one.
It's a big one. It's one of those things that has kept philosophers and scientists busy for ages, and we're going to try to unpack it together.
It's a classic philosophical puzzle, for sure. How does our inner world, you know, all of our thoughts and feelings and experiences, how does that connect to the physical world outside of us?
Right. It's like, on the one hand, our thoughts and feelings feel so real, so important. And then science tells us it's all just, you know, neurons firing in our brains. So that's where your source material comes in. This fascinating chapter one from The Mind-Body Problem by Kirk Ludwig seems like a great roadmap for this deep dive.
Absolutely. Ludwig does a fantastic job of laying the groundwork. But before we jump into the solutions people have come up with, we really need to be clear on what we're even talking about.
Right.
What do we mean by mental and physical?
Yeah, because you might be thinking, okay, mental and physical. I kind of have a general idea of what those mean, but what do we mean by mental? Well, Ludwig points out two key characteristics of the mental. The first is consciousness.
Okay.
That's just that direct knowing of your own thoughts and feelings, that direct awareness. Like, think about remembering the taste of chocolate. You just know what that experience is like. You don't need any proof, right?
Yeah, it's that immediate subjective experience that makes the mental so difficult to pin down in physical terms.
Right.
And then there's intentionality, the second big characteristic of the mental. And this means that our thoughts are always about something.
It's like you can believe in unicorns, even though they don't exist.
Exactly.
But your belief is still about something, even if it's not a real thing.
Exactly. Our thoughts have this kind of directedness, this aboutness, which is a real hallmark of the mental. Now, the physical side of things is a little trickier to define. We can't just rely on our current understanding of physics because, you know, science is always moving forward, always evolving.
So if we can't just point to physics as it stands today, how do we define what's physical in this context?
Ludwig suggests we think about the general kinds of properties that physics usually deals with. Things like size, shape, motion, you know, those measurable aspects of reality. Philosophers back in the 17th and 18th century called these primary qualities.
Okay. So instead of getting bogged down in specific scientific theories, we're looking at these broader categories just to keep our options open.
Exactly. It's about laying the groundwork with these basic concepts. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. Ludwig lays out these four ideas, these four theses that seem pretty obvious on their own. But when you put them all together, they create this massive conflict, the mind-body problem.
Okay, hit me with these mind-bending theses.
Okay, the first one is realism. And it's basically the idea that, yeah, mental properties really do exist. We have thoughts, we have feelings. This seems undeniable, right?
Yeah, I mean.
Then there's conceptual autonomy. This one says that mental properties aren't just physical properties dressed up in different words. They're distinct categories.
I think most people would agree with that, at least intuitively. It doesn't feel like my thoughts are just a bunch of, you know, atoms bouncing around.
Yeah.
What are the other two?
All right, number three, constituent explanatory sufficiency. And this is getting into how we explain the world. It says that everything about a thing can be explained by its parts and how those parts are arranged. Physics have been incredibly successful with this approach, breaking things down to their fundamental components and figuring out how they work together. And finally, there's constituent non-mentalism.
Okay.
And this basically says that the tiniest building blocks of the universe, think atoms and such, don't have minds themselves.
Right.
No tiny thinkers running around down there.
So like no little people controlling the atoms.
No. So here's the mind-blowing part. If everything boils down to these mindless building blocks, how in the world does something as rich and complex as your mind emerge? This, my friend, is the heart of the mind-body problem.
It really is. It's like,
yeah.
Okay, so we can explain all this stuff in the universe with physics, but then how do we get you and me talking
exactly.
And having this conversation?
Right.
It was wild. And over the centuries, philosophers have come up with some really creative solutions to this problem, each tackling that conflict in a different way. And some of them get pretty wild. Okay, I am so ready to hear about these solutions. Let's dive in. Okay, so we've got these four ideas about the mind and the physical world, and they're clashing like crazy. It's like a philosophical traffic jam. Where do we even go from here?
Well, think of it this way. To get traffic flowing again, sometimes you have to close off one of the lanes.
Yeah.
That's kind of what these solutions do. They reject one of those four ideas to try and resolve the conflict.
So it's like a philosophical game of would you rather.
Yeah.
Which fundamental idea are you willing to give up to make sense of the mind?
That's a great way to put it. Ludwig takes us through some of the main categories of solutions, and some of them really push the boundaries of what we normally think about reality.
Okay, let's hear it. I'm ready for my mind to be blown.
All right, the first category is what we can call the mental particle theories. These theories say, what if the universe isn't made of totally mindless stuff? What if some of those tiny building blocks actually have mental properties built right in?
Instead of just plain old atoms, we've got like mind atoms.
You could think of it that way. Some fundamental particles would have both physical properties and mental properties.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the most famous version of this is substance dualism, championed by the philosopher Descartes.
Ah, yes, Descartes. He's practically a household name. Didn't he famously say, I think, therefore I am?
That's the one.
Yeah.
And for Descartes, that ability to think meant that the mind was something completely separate from the physical world. He argued that the mind and body are like two different substances.
So in this view, our minds are kind of floating around in our bodies, somehow connected, but not really made of the same stuff.
That's the basic idea. But this whole separate substances idea runs into some major issues. If mind and matter are so fundamentally different, how do they interact? How does my mind control my body? Or how does my body affect my mood?
Yeah, it's like trying to fit two puzzle pieces together that just don't belong.
Exactly. That question of mind-body interaction has plagued dualism for centuries. But despite those challenges, Descartes' ideas have been hugely influential in Western thought.
Yeah, it's understandable, right? There's this strong intuitive feeling that our minds are separate from our physical bodies, even if it's hard to explain the detail.
For sure. Now, there are other mental particle theories out there.
Yeah.
Panpsychism is one that really stretches the imagination.
Hey, I'm all ears. What's panpsychism all about?
Panpsychism takes this idea of mind particles and just goes all in. It says that everything, and I mean everything, has some level of mind or consciousness, from humans to animals to plants to rocks, you name it.
Whoa. So like my coffee cup is having an existential crisis right now.
Well, maybe. It's a pretty radical idea. But it raises these fascinating questions about just how widespread consciousness might be. Maybe we've been underestimating the inner lives of things all along.
That's a wild thought. So to recap, we've got dualism, which says mind and body are totally separate substances. And then we've got panpsychism, which says everything in the universe has at least some level of mind. Are there any other mind particle theories out there?
Ludwig also mentions double aspect theory and special particle theory. But let's move on to a different category of solutions. Emergentism. This approach takes a different tack.
Okay, tell me more. What's the deal with emergentism?
Emergentism says maybe the basic bits of the universe don't have minds.
Yeah.
But when you arrange those bits in a certain way, when you get enough complexity, something totally new emerges the mind.
It's like you said with the cake analogy. The flour, the sugar, the eggs, they're all fine on their own, but put them together in the right way and bam, you've got something totally new and delicious. That's the essence of emergentism. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts.
Perfect example. Emergentists argue that mental properties arise from these complex physical systems in a way that you can't fully predict just by knowing about the individual parts. It's about the interaction and the relationships.
So our minds are like a cake. I kind of like that idea. But doesn't emergentism raise another tricky question? If my mind just emerges from physical stuff, does it have any real power to affect the physical world in return?
You've hit on a key point there. It's the question of downward causation. Can mental states like your thoughts and your desires actually influence your physical body and the world around you?
Right. If my thoughts are just a byproduct of my brain activity, are they actually doing anything?
That's the debate. Some emergentists say, yes, mental properties have this downward causal influence, but a more common view is something called epiphenomenalism.
Epiphenomenalism. Say that 10 times fast. But seriously, what does it mean?
It basically says that the mind is like a shadow cast by the brain. The shadow is there, it's real, but it doesn't actually do anything. In this view, mental states are caused by physical processes, but they don't have any causal power themselves.
So my thoughts and feelings are just along for the ride, not really steering the ship.
Exactly. It's a tough idea to wrap your head around, but it's a serious contender in the mind-body debate.
Okay, so we've talked about mind particles and we've talked about things emerging from complexity. What other ways have people tried to solve this mind-body puzzle?
Well, there's another big category called reductionism. This approach says, what if mental properties aren't something totally separate from physical properties? What if it's like saying that water is H2O? There are two different ways of talking about the same thing.
So like maybe my feeling of joy is literally just a certain pattern of neurons firing in my brain.
That's the general idea. There are a couple of main types of reductionism. First, there's functionalism. This view says that mental states are defined by their function, by what they do within a system.
So kind of like software running on a computer. The software can do the same things on different types of hardware, right? Maybe the mind is like the software and the brain is the hardware it runs on.
That's a good analogy. Functionalists would say that mental states are all about the roles they play, the processes they're involved in, not so much about what they're physically made of. But even functionalism has its critics.
Like what?
Well, one famous thought experiment that challenges functionalism is called Block's China Brain. Imagine you had billions of people in China, each simulating the function of a single neuron in the brain. They're all communicating with each other, sending signals back and forth, perfectly mimicking the activity of a real brain. The question is, would that giant network of people actually be conscious?
Whoa, that's a really trippy image. It makes you wonder if just copying the functions is enough to create a genuine mind.
It does. And then there's another type of reductionism called psychophysical identity theory. This one takes a more direct approach. It says that specific mental states are literally identical to specific brain states.
So my feeling of joy is a particular pattern of neurons firing in my brain, not just analogous to it.
That's right. Psychophysical identity theory tries to tie the mental and the physical together very tightly. This helps explain how the mind can have real causal power because, well, brain states definitely affect the physical world. But this view also raises some questions.
Like, does it mean only creatures with brains exactly like ours can experience joy? Does a dog's joy look totally different in their brain so it's not really the same thing?
Those are the kinds of questions psychophysical identity theorists have to grapple with. But it's interesting to compare this to how we learn about physical substances in general. Think about gold, for example.
Okay, gold. What about it?
We used to think gold was just, you know, shiny and valuable. But then we discovered its atomic structure. That's atomic number 79. And that changed our whole understanding of what gold is. Maybe we'll have similar aha moments about the mind as we learn more about the brain.
I see what you're saying. Maybe right now we only have this surface level understanding of the mind. And as science progresses, we'll discover something more fundamental that ties it to the physical world in a way we can't even imagine yet.
Exactly. That's part of what makes this whole mind-body problem so fascinating. But there's one more category of solutions we need to explore, and it's perhaps the most radical of them all. Eliminativism.
Eliminativism. That sounds intense. What's that all about?
Eliminativists are kind of the rebels of the mind-body debate.
Mm.
They say, you know what? Forget all this talk about mental properties. They don't actually exist.
Hold on. Are you telling me my thoughts and feelings are just illusions? That I don't really feel happy or sad?
Well, that's exactly what they're arguing. They think our everyday way of talking about the mind, what they call folk psychology, is just wrong. It's like an outdated theory that needs to be replaced with a more scientific understanding of the brain.
Wow, that's a pretty big pill to swallow.
Definitely. Eliminativism is the most counterintuitive solution to the mind-body problem. It challenges our basic assumptions about ourselves in a really fundamental way.
So we've got this whole spectrum of solutions, from mind particles to emerging consciousness to the mind being just a way of talking about the brain. It's a lot to take in. But before we wrap up our deep dive into the mind-body problem, there's one more concept that Ludwig brings up that I think is worth exploring.
You're talking about metaphysical necessity, right? It comes up a lot in these discussions.
Exactly. It sounds super complicated, but is it really that mind-blowing? Can you break it down for us?
Well, you often hear people say that certain things are metaphysically necessary. It's like saying they just have to be true no matter what. It's not just a law of physics. It's like it's woven into the fabric of reality.
Okay.
A good example is the idea that water is H2O.
So even if the laws of physics were totally different in some other universe, water would still be H2O.
That's the idea. But Ludwig asks this really interesting question. Is metaphysical necessity really a thing out there in the world? Or is it more about how we're understanding these concepts?
So like how our understanding of gold changed when we figured out its atomic structure.
Right.
Maybe what we think is metaphysically necessary is actually just our current level of understanding.
Exactly.
As we learn more about the world and about the mind, our ideas might change.
That's exactly what Ludwig is suggesting. It's like we're constantly refining our concepts as we discover more about reality. So what we call metaphysically necessary today might just be a reflection of our current knowledge, not some ultimate truth.
That's a really good point. It reminds us to be humble about what we think we know for sure. After all, look how much our understanding of the physical world has changed over the centuries. So after going through all these different solutions to the mind-body problem, what's the big takeaway for our listener?
I think the main point is that the mind-body problem sticks around because our everyday experience and what science tells us seem to pull in different directions. We feel like our minds are these real powerful things, but then science comes along and says, hey, it's all just physical processes in your brain.
It's like we're caught in between these two different ways of seeing the world, and neither one fully satisfies us.
Right. It's this fundamental tension that keeps philosophers and scientists coming back to this problem again and again. Even without any definitive solutions, just wrestling with these questions can lead to some pretty profound insights.
Yeah, it really makes you think about what it means to be human, to have this inner world of thoughts and feelings that feels so separate from the physical world around us. So to leave our listener with something to ponder, let's end with a final thought-provoking question.
Okay, how about this one? If all of our thoughts and feelings do come down to physical processes in the brain, does that make them any less real or important? Or does it make the material world even more amazing, capable of creating something as rich and complex as the human mind?
Right. And on the flip side, if consciousness is more fundamental than we realize, if it's woven into the fabric of the universe in some way we don't yet understand, then how does that change how we see ourselves and our place in the cosmos?
These are questions we may never be able to fully answer, but they're definitely worth asking.
Couldn't agree more. Well, thanks for joining us for this deep dive into the mind-body problem. It's one of those mysteries that continues to fascinate and challenge us. Keep those brains buzzing, everyone.